Today's short lecture is on Jordan Peterson, 12 Rules for Life in the Millennial Identity Crisis by Gordon Kuechner. Gordon Kuechner is a staff worker with graduate students and faculty at University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. So what's the attraction to Jordan Peterson in the first place? It seems that scientific or exclusive humanism proves inadequate to our natural quest for meaning and significance. In fact, a cold universe that is deaf to our pain and aspirations, a universe of mere matter and blind chance, leaves us without purpose and meaning. Secondly, people are searching for psychological and relational insight into their brokenness, for truth about the inner self, emotions, motivations, and pain. They have struggles and they want answers. And Jordan Peterson is offering answers to those particular struggles as a clinical psychologist. Thirdly, Peterson is willing to wrestle with some of the toughest existential or big life questions, both philosophical and religious, social and cultural. He thinks more deeply than many about the anthropology of evil, for instance, and the power of the lie, and even the big lie, which we know from propaganda or from previous ideological adventures. Fourthly, many are drawn to his fatherly advice to cultivate the inner self, to grow in character, honor, and respect, basically to grow up. This is his strength in practical wisdom or phronesis. Then there is his promise that mature meaning can help us survive the crucible of suffering. And this is part of his tragic optimism, which he gets from the school of Viktor Frankl as part of positive psychology. Next, there are many practical suggestions in Peterson about the realignment of self, coming to grips with my own personal chaos, nihilism, resentment, and lack of direction. You know, our young millennial might say, okay, Jordan, you're right. I need to grow up. I'm almost 30 and still living in my parents' basement and playing video games for 12 hours a day. We all need courage to look into the abyss, face our shadow, our dark side, as Jung would say, our draw to malevolence. And Peterson is big on showing us that there is that malevolent side of us, that malevolent draw to us. Next, Peterson resonates in the age of anatheism. Anatheism is defined by Richard Kearney from Boston College. It's the search for God or higher meaning after the death of God. That is, in the age of nihilism. The key concept here is one's openness to epiphany, in an otherwise disenchanted world. For some millennials, Peterson has even become a kind of, they call him a gateway drug to Christianity. He's pointed the way to a deeper faith. And finally, he recognizes an order of being which is attractive to both religious and non-religious alike. It intrigues without forcing them into a particular worldview. So that's part of the attraction to Peterson. What is the age of Peterson? And we could look at the book by Charles Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities, just the introduction. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the time or age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. This sets the stage for Peterson. I have noted that there's something about suffering and tragedy which Peterson focuses on as a sort of a nexus concern that draws people from a religious, people from an ethical, people from a scientific, and even people from an aesthetic background together brings them together to dialogue at the table. In a sense, Peterson reconnects the culture spheres that have been split apart since the time of Immanuel Kant. I draw on the insights of Calvin Schragg, The Self After Postmodernity, for the discussion about culture spheres. As you might realize, in the age of early modernity, the scientific culture sphere tends to dominate. In the age of late modernity, the aesthetic culture sphere tends to get an ideology of the aesthetic. The aesthetic dominates. So that's quite something that Peterson is able to call those culture spheres together to build a nexus between them. And I think that's part of his existential appeal, what captures people right away. He seems to have a depth to him that others do not. So suffering and tragedy is the nexus. What can I doubt? The reality of suffering, he says. It brooks no arguments. Nihilists cannot undermine it with skepticism. Totalitarians cannot banish it. Cynics cannot escape from its reality. Suffering is real, and the artful infliction of suffering on another for its own sake is wrong. That became the cornerstone of my belief. This is from 12 Rules of Life, for Life, page 197. Well, we started this short talk by looking at the crisis of millennials and the way that Peterson is really connecting with millennials. And that's what we want to deal with in this next section. We want to map the existential crisis of millennials. To some extent, this is a shorter version of that, but it leads to a lot of other sources which could take you into more detail. So first of all, there's a lack of moral grounding. Many millennials have been brought up on moral subjectivism or radical tolerance. One might even call it a dogma of relativism. And at the same time, they've been taught, in contradiction with this, a strong, assertive political correctness. You see this articulated in the foreword of the 12 Rules for Life, or in Chapter 5 of the book by Chantal Delsol, a French philosopher called Icarus Fallen. So today's education really does conflict the student. Their education and their mentoring is conflicted by these two extremes, the extreme of relativism and the extreme of sometimes political dogmatism, political correctness dogmatism. Secondly, many millennials have a lack of a meaningful story to make sense of life. They're suffering from cultural amnesia, biblical illiteracy. They've lost many of the great stories. Which is why sometimes Peterson, in order to connect with them, starts with fairy tales or nursery rhymes or like Pinocchio, something from their childhood, at least some story that they can get into and see the import of. I met a professor at the university from the University of Toronto this past summer, Dr. Alistair Smith, who has got a project where he's using Shakespeare to recover a story, recover this sense of heritage and cultural heritage for inner city youth in London, England, New York City in New York, or Toronto in Toronto. Thirdly, we hear a lot written today about the wounded masculine soul, full of self-doubt, relationship issues, combined with a lack of realism and self-discipline. Also, in the age of feminism, some of these young boys have been beaten down, told that they're the problem, and they are an oppressive force, and so they feel this shame, and they need some help, some support to realign their identity. Fourthly, there is a tremendous addiction to technology and easy access entertainment. You've probably heard about the Netflix binging that millennials are quite noted for. So life is free, it's quick, it's kind of like an opioid drug And Simon Sinek, in his video, Millennials in the Workplace, captures this in a beautiful way. This is a video that has kind of broken the internet. He uses good humor to get our attention on this issue. So there is a kind of attention deficit problem in millennials. Next, many millennials are experiencing nihilism, a loss of meaning caused by scientism, radical individualism, and late capitalist hyper-consumerism. I'm writing about this at the moment. Notre Dame's Christian Smith, he's a famous top sociologist at Notre Dame. His book, Souls in Transition, says that millennials are people 18 to 23 in the United States are kind of soft ontological anti-realists, epistemological skeptics, perspectivalists, constructivalists, and moral intuitionists. So there's a softening of the foundation for meaning in millennials. It's a particular part of their crisis. Then comes the performance anxiety at work. This derives, as Matthew Crawford in his book, The World Beyond Your Head, points out, it derives from a lack of a strong moral identity and good moral interlocutors, the loss of the village, so to speak. So in this relativistic, subjectivistic environment, the corporation's bottom line swoops in to this moral vacuum and shapes one's identity and purpose. The individual is measured by quantitative performance, not personal character. Has anyone mentioned Amazon at this point? So in summary of this existential crisis, there's a disorientation, a sense of uncertainty, a kind of self-loathing within the crisis of affirmation, cynicism, anger, resentment, skyrocketing depression. And yet, there's that longing for purpose, for impact, for challenge, and even heroism. As Simon Sinek asks millennials in the workplace what they really want. They want free food, beanbags, and they want purpose, and they want to have an impact. So there really is a positive side to this crisis. Well, what is the solution? So if we draw back and we try to figure out what is, in the 12 Rules for Life, what is Peterson actually offering millennials in terms of a solution to their crisis? How is he really making a difference in individual lives? So I think I could say that he is offering a psychological solution. For him, the epicenter is the individual. That it's the primacy of the individual. That is the answer to the crisis of millennials. It's not the selfish, entitled, narcissistic individual who's indifferent to social demands and the common good. Nor is it the corrupt, toxic individual who's a danger to self and society, easily manipulated, lured by tribalism, i.e., who do we hate today, or ideology, utopian visions of the far right or far left, which leads to various forms of totalitarianism. Peterson is quite against those extremes. He's against the extremes of nihilism, which is total chaos of the individual, and the extreme of totalitarianism, being too sure of yourself and dogmatic. And then thirdly, he is really focused on the positive side, he's focused on the person with high goals, the person who has focus in their life. He believes that that person, the high goal focused person, can endure suffering and keep their meaning intact. That's a very significant, I could highlight that and say that that's a very significant and part of the answer from Peterson's perspective. And you'll see that throughout the talks that he gives on the internet, on YouTube, as well as in his book, 12 Rules. It's the alert, honest, courageous, articulate, and responsible individual that gives hope for society, according to Peterson. So he wants young people to pay attention, wake up to reality, to be intelligent, to learn how to articulate, how self-articulate, develop their language, their ability to argue their case, and that sort of thing. To be reasonable, to be able to examine their assumptions, their axioms, to self-critique. Very important to dialogue, and Peterson is big on dialogue. To be responsible, to take responsibility for their lives and for themselves, for the outcomes. And this, he says, does involve sacrifice. Don't be afraid of sacrifice. Don't be afraid to suffer for the good. So one might also look at Bernard Lonergan's markers of self-transcendence, which parallels this concern. So that's another source of Peterson's kind of solution. Secondly, it's an individualism that is engaged with and committed to a natural and moral reality, a kind of critical realism and moral realism. Peterson believes in a kind of Tao, an intercultural moral heritage, similar to what we find in C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man or Dennis Danielson's book, The Tao of Right and Wrong, most recently published. It's that idea that there's a moral fabric that we can tap into. It's objective, it's outside of ourselves. It's not just a result of our own individual choice, but it's something to aspire to. One can aspire to the higher good, the greater good. Thirdly, this individual must be committed to telling the truth and aspiring to the good, as you will find in Rule 7 and 8 in the book 12 Rules. This is the idea of personal authenticity, being true to yourself, being true to the good, having integrity. The individual must be willing to bear the burden of his or her own being, to take seriously their own existence and their own place in the larger fabric of things, the larger structure of society. A good example of this would be the Nobel Prize winner Malala Yousafzai, who very much fought for education of girls in Pakistan. There's also the element of Stoic virtues. So Peterson does like virtues, like courage, self-management, prudence, and justice. So his self-dependent method for recovery of moral agency is a good start, even if it's not sufficient. So that element of Stoic virtues is definitely there. Okay, just to zoom out a little bit, if we're looking at Peterson from the perspective of Soren Kierkegaard's three stages of development, Peterson moves us upward from the aesthetic to the ethical stage. You have the aesthetic, and then above that is the ethical, above that is the religious. Peterson's project is largely working at the level of the ethical, bringing the hedonic aesthete into the ethical stage of development. He's telling that person, choose meaning rather than expedience, Rule 7. It involves responsible self-care, Rule 2, listening to the other, Rule 9, and good citizenship. This cuts back to his Stoicism. We can make meaning by reducing suffering once we have realigned the bitter, aimless self to the good and start telling the truth. It's telling the truth to oneself and also telling the truth to society. Calvin Schrag, the self after postmodernity, calls this a weak form of transcendence. It's moving the person forward on a horizontal plane to become a better person, more responsible, etc. Now, as we bring Peterson, I want to bring Peterson in dialogue with the famous Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, famous for his book A Secular Age, or in this case, Sources of a Self is his other major substantial work. I guess he has produced a new book in a recent year called The Language Animal. But these two books, Sources of the Self and a secular age are key books in understanding how Charles Taylor might engage Jordan Peterson on his quest to rebuild the individual's moral agency, to give a stronger soul to the individual. Taylor engages Peterson by going a step further. He wants to wager on a transcendent turn to agape love. He wants a strong form of transcendence. He brings the aesthete through the ethical stage and into the religious, the direction of freedom, interdependence with radical alterity. This is a difficult concept to explain in a short talk like this, but I wrote about this in my PhD thesis and found that Taylor is quite powerful in his capturing of the importance of the good and the hyper-good in moral discourse, in moral identity and spirituality. So Taylor might say, let's leverage Peterson by resolving his moral agency upward. This move pushes him into a larger moral horizon, a larger home of the mind or social imaginary. He may feel a bit uncomfortable with strong and transcendence, but ultimately it will offer a more robust moral agency, a stronger resilience, as we find in the work of Angela Duckworth called Grit. Both gentlemen have a hierarchy of values, and they both have a hyper good. Peterson holds sacrifice, not happiness itself, but sacrifice as the highest controlling good. The highest form of life is to learn to sacrifice. And the archetype of that sacrifice he sees as Jesus of Nazareth in the Bible, in the New Testament. For Taylor, he sees the hyper good as agape love. And maybe we'll be able to talk about that a little more in another session. I'd like to talk about that idea of a transcendent turn to agape love to get us out of the crisis of affirmation in late modernity. So Peterson, as an existential humanist, sees the source of the good as largely within the self-dependent individual, choosing, acting, creating meaning, inventing self, even in the face of nihilism, brokenness, and despair. The individual must fight chaos and build some order through setting noble goals, willing to sacrifice, take responsibility, and make a difference, reduce suffering in the world. It's ironic in a sense because, as you know, Peterson does not like the postmodernists like Michel Foucault, but there's a certain kind of resonance between Peterson's solution to the contemporary crisis for millennials, as you would find in Michel Foucault, the French philosopher, and his concept of the aesthetic reinvention of the self. Peterson also suggests that consulting the mythopoetic stories of the Bible can help one's self-understanding. And that's what he's done in his series, his YouTube series, Teaching Through Genesis, landing many key figures in that process. And he tries to draw out the psychological value of these various biblical archetypes and teach us something about ourselves through that. So the question I have, in contrasting Peterson with Charles Taylor, does Peterson implode the religious into the ethical? To use Kierkegaard's three stages of development language. And I have a feeling that he resists. He has this kind of a ceiling on the development of the individual, the healing of the individual self, and he doesn't quite get fully to the religious, even though he shows interest in the biblical, in Eastern religions, in, that sort of thing, religious myths. So in the end, Taylor believes that an understanding of strong transcendence is critical to our best and most robust account of the moral world. My contention is that Peterson's resistance to strong transcendence is a choice to constrict the moral horizon and thereby the moral imagination. It's a refusal, it entails a refusal of epiphany and a weak understanding of grace that many search for in the age of anatheism. This is a decision with consequences. So by resisting the religious, by resisting transcendence, I think he's weak in this area. He's weak in the area of transcendence, and he's quite weak in the area of the economy of grace, the importance of grace in the healing of the individual and the recovery of moral agency and confidence. Peterson takes an existential leap of faith. He says, faith is the realization that the tragic irrationalities of life must be countered by an equally irrational commitment to the essential goodness of being. Again, we're back to the idea of goodness of being. But he shies away from engagement with the goodness of a personal God. So the goodness of being is not necessarily a personal being. Is Peterson working against himself and his project of moral agency recovery? That's my question. That's the question I want to leave us with. I just will say one other stipulation or modification. There are two different ways of seeing or understanding the world, the epistemological and the hermeneutical. I won't go into them in great detail, but Peterson, his phenomenological approach, his attention to the actual human experience, seems to fit better the hermeneutical way of seeing, as he attempts to recover meaning and purpose, to re-enchant the world, and to the, and recover authentic human subjectivity, drama, moral agency, purpose, consciousness, and conscientiousness, the deep, substantial things of human personhood. In a sense, like a colossus, he tries to span the two ways. He has a respect for neuroscience and evolutionary psychology as a limited discipline, but to recover meaning and moral agency, he leans towards the hermeneutical way of seeing the world. And I think that's quite significant. He is not into the ideology of scientism. He doesn't rule out religion. Science is necessary but not sufficient for our psychological well-being and for the recovery of meaning. It is important at the end of the day to realize that Jordan Peterson is deeply concerned with living a meaningful life, one that conforms to core values and is part of a larger dynamic. Indeed, his primary in-depth work is called Maps of Meaning. This precedes 12 Rules for Life. It tells the story of how he is striving to connect the dots between our subjective lives and the themes and struggles of the universe at large. In that book, he lays out the view that many humans throughout the centuries have represented the mythic nature of the universe through archetypal lenses of the dialectic between the feminine chaos and the masculine order. He also finds compelling the archetypal narratives of suffering, sacrifice, and redemption. I'll just make a footnote about Notre Dame sociologist Christian Smith, his definition of the nihilism among millennials, 18 to 23-year-olds. The soft ontological anti-realism means that there's no really real world. It's only the one I construct. Epistemological skeptics must question everything. Perspectivalists, mine is the only one of many ways to see this, so it's just my individual perspective. Constructivists, they're tasked with building or inventing their self, their morality, moral universe from the ground up. Tremendous challenge. Moral intuitionism, my feelings about the situation or decision is the key factor. So that's a little bit of a footnote there. Thanks for listening to this talk on the recovery of the moral agency in Jordan Peterson in dialogue with Charles Taylor. Hope you have fun following up some of these tips for good resources to read. Thank you very much.